And good afternoon. Welcome back to Topical Currents for this Monday. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is away. Thanks so much for joining us. We welcome Watchdog Report publisher Dan Ricker, who goes where and when we cannot.
Right. Thank you, Bonnie. Great to be back.
Thanks for coming in. We're going to look back at the 2014 Florida legislative session, which just ended on Friday. But first, congratulations to you, today being exactly your 15th anniversary on the Watchdog Report. So
a strange fork in the road. I never thought I'd be doing it. You know, I thought maybe 5 years, 6 years. At 10 years, I thought that was a long time. But 15 is becoming, it's been a remarkable journey. And I thank all the people that have helped me and supported me over the years.
Yeah, how have you survived?
No, I essentially live off the community. I mean, people, you know, someone's, you know, a grandmother sends me, you know, $20 or $19, and with always with a little note. I wish it could be more, but thank you for going and whatever. And I have bigger, you know, sponsors. The Knight Foundation's been great to me over the years. And, you know, it's been tough. It hasn't been, I don't think, and I know some bloggers are finding this out themselves. It's hard to do something like this and also live, you know, because I don't have a trust fund or whatever.
Right. So, what inspired you to start it?
Well, if you look back in the, you know, 98, 99, and 2000 down here, we had people in municipal government, city of Miami, a couple commissioners were arrested, a county commissioner was arrested. And, you know, there was this huge force of lobbyists. And I used to call them the princes. I didn't know who they were at the time. Now I know most of them. But I used to think that, you know, the citizens needed someone who knew the issues and whatever. And what really changed was a pivotal thing was Dr. Redmond Burke, who's the pediatric cardiac surgeon at Children's Hospital here. He gave me Bill Gates's book, Business at the Speed of Thought. And I read it. And it was talking about how you could use the internet as like an information nervous system. And in my case, having lived in Japan and in China and 5 years in Sydney, I knew how, you know, I mean, these were competitive markets and information was key. And I thought, you know, someone needs to have an overlay, an information overlay of all these big institutions. I mean, between the county, the school board here, this is the fourth largest school district, public school district in the nation. It's not a small entity. Jackson does more in charity care, for example, now than the whole city of Miami budget. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these are big institutions and impact people on a daily basis. But I used to call them giant ships at the night that would just pass each other and never had an idea what the other was doing. And we were wasting tax dollars and we're not a rich community.
So do you feel you've accomplished what you set out to, and are you still accomplishing what you want to?
Yeah, I think you have. First of all, one of the things I realized, if you got good people on boards that are oversight boards, for example, here at the public school system, we have the audit committee and budget review committee. And when I first got there, there had been someone that chaired that, what I call the firewall, the citizens firewall, for 10 years. It wasn't until 2004 that I was finally able to get him to, he stepped down as because of his cardiologist recommended that he step down because of, I busted him on a sunshine violation where he was emailing other members and it just became, but you know, I mean, I had someone at the Herald at the time say, oh, you'll never get rid of this guy. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've had normal leadership changes every 2 years. The board is it's one of the reasons you don't see some of the big scandals that you know coming out of the school district like you used to, is you've got some talented people really acting as the watchdogs and the watchers and safeguards for all this money and how it's spent. And it also forces the administration, if they know they have people that will challenge certain things they want to do or whatever, mm-hmm. they either don't do it or will be less inclined to do it.
Right.
You know.
If
they think they have a blank slate, they're off to the races.
Right. So if somebody wants the Watchdog Report?
You just go send me an email, Watchdog Report, or publisher at watchdogreport.net.
Publisher at watchdogreport.net, and you get it every Sunday.
Yes, and it's online at watchdogreport.net and hosted by University of Miami with the Knight Foundation funding it.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks.
So moving on to this legislative session, the first time there's a surplus rather than a deficit in 6 years. And I guess my first question is why? And why was it $77.1 billion? Why was it so much, the budget?
Well, the revenues statewide, and sales taxes, tourism, and everything else, real estate is finally, you know, after tanking in 08.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget, when Jeb Bush was governor, the budget used to be about $49 billion. In this current one, the $71.1 billion, that's a 3.5% increase from this past year. So the economy is bouncing back, whether or not it's exclusively because of Governor Scott, which is like, you know, I mean, yes, his mantra has always been jobs,
right,
and the economy. There was also, been the resurgence, for example, of South America's economies. And, you know, it's had a huge impact here in Florida and here in South Florida, where a lot of foreign money came in, bought up all the, you know, the condos that used to be empty and vacant and dark.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a real question, would we have these condo corridors of, you know, just high-end product with no one in them.
How much of that budget comes from South Florida? I mean, how much is generated by this area?
Well, the CFO has said it's about 33%. And it's one of the reasons why we always take up the mantra, our leaders, you know, we want our share. We're a donor community. We appreciate that there are, I mean, people, I don't think, appreciate out of 67 Florida counties, some of them, there's like 5,000 people in them. I mean, they're
right,
very, very
small.
And so they need a little help too. But historically, our delegation would many times fight among themselves, and we didn't get our fair share. We did this year. We did fairly well, and I got to say, because I cover Jackson, they were able to shift or slow down and defer the implementation of a federal funding for indigent and public hospitals that would have cost Jackson $140 million still, you know, this year, and they were able to defer it till next year.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that's a big win for us. I mean, Jackson, because they do $500-600 million in charity care, and there's about $350 million of public money that comes in to, you know, support that. It's, you know,
still a lot.
You know, and Carlos Magoya has done a remarkable job, but it's still when you're dealing with that kind of reality on a day-to-day basis, a hit of $140 million could be devastating.
Mm-hmm. So, how much do you think the session was affected by being an election year, and what was accomplished? Well, how much do you think that affected it?
Oh, I think it affected it a lot. There wasn't the you had the speaker and the Senate president happened to be friends, which was handy. It's an election year where everyone's up, which is why I don't think there'll be any special session. For example, the gambling compact that Scott was trying to do. But it's when you have 77, I mean, when you have that kind of money available, life is good. And, yes, there were a lot of turkeys, as they're called up there, were little pet projects.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's tougher for the it's tough when the legislature doesn't have the, you know, a big number, or is like in 08 when it was,
right,
significantly smaller. And everything was, the question was, what's being cut? Now, some of it, education fared better. There's some infrastructure projects that got, you know, funding. I mean, the Miami Marina or the Marine Stadium.
Marine Stadium.
I think they got $1 million or whatever. There's some local stuff that went through. And I don't think Scott's on a, though, historically, when he first, this first 2 years, he vetoed a lot, you know, 350, maybe 400 million 1 year. I think he'll be much more judicious this year because of the election. Let the you know, it roll out. And also, you know, the state actually banked another, I think, $3 billion into the reserve. So, you know, in that regard, the state is in a pretty healthy fiscal shape.
Right. Let's just talk about, for a second, the governor's race itself. I know, I mean, you just mentioned about education getting funding
right.
in the legislature, but I got an email, actually, from the Charlie Crist campaign.
Right.
I don't know how I got that, saying...
I got it, too.
You got it? Yeah. Saying that he didn't give any enough to education,
right.
that he missed education. So...
Well, because of an earlier cut. But that's, you know, it's almost like DCF, the Department of Children and Family, and the Herald did a great, you know, series of stories on lost innocence.
Right.
And the terrible tragedy, and while there was some reform, there was, you know, critics are saying there isn't enough money going into, for example, DCF or, you know, other projects.
But a lot was done regarding sexual predators, sexual battery,
right,
human trafficking.
Right, right. But that's those are laws rather than funding a state entity that has to provide the actual services.
So DCF didn't get...
Well, not as much. I mean, the supporters wanted more.
Okay.
You know, we'll see. It's a very vexing problem. You know, foster kids, some are in great homes, other ones, you know, they run away, or there's other issues that may have been involved. And it's, you know, I've always felt, though, UPS, and this is a terrible analogy, but I mean, UPS knows where every package is, and when we lose a child, we just don't know where they are, and they've been seen or something. I never can understand how we don't have a better handle, especially when a worker, state worker, sees the child. We don't know a better idea of where they are.
Exactly. You know. We're speaking with Dan Ricker. He's the publisher and editor of the Watchdog Report on today's Topical Currents, talking about 15 years of the Watchdog Report and the 2014 legislative session, which just ended Friday evening. If you want to join in the conversation, the number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. So what is this, the legalization of a non-euphoric, low-THC form of medical marijuana? What does that mean?
Well, I think they're trying to, ignore the pun, nip it in the bud, the... there's also a constitutional amendment about
legalizing
marijuana. And that one is the one that, you know, what the legislature picked is a much narrower form and how it's administered, et cetera, versus the state. If voters give it a 60% yes approval, which polls show is probably likely, would probably end up with a situation that's similar to, say, Colorado or California and Washington, where they're just starting the same. People have passed similar kinds of...
Well, in California, it's different, I believe, from Colorado and Washington. I think Colorado and Washington, it has been made legal, whereas in California, it's just medical marijuana is legal.
Oh, is that they're right?
I believe so.
Yeah. It's definitely... you know, in the state of Florida, we have 1 million people in our prisons. So there's, you know, whatever happens with that, I think we'll start to perhaps reduce this roadway for so many people into jail.
You're talking about from marijuana possession?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think they're. You know, now the critics argue, okay, it's like drinking. If you allow drinking, 10% of the people will become alcoholics. You know, will that same ratio, or will you still have that same social impact with pot? Probably, but you know, it's a question that at this point is now going to be settled by the state's voters.
So if it'll be on the ballot in November.
Yes.
And if it's 60%.
Right. It would have to, the legislature changed the the level of, used to be 50% of the voters in a, something would go in the Constitution. But remember, you had some really weird constitutional amendments that were inserted. I'm trying to think, the one with the pigs, I can't remember it. There was,
oh, the crating?
Yes. Yes. I mean, there was a couple of odd ones.
Yes.
And so the legislator made it, would only become an official.
The gestation crates, yeah, right, for the pigs.
It would go to 60%. And people are fine. I mean, you know, that's a high barrier. And so we'll see.
And what about getting back to the education issues just for a minute, the bill that passed granting in-state tuition to undocumented, right, students.
Which is a big deal down here.
Yes.
And because we're kind of the central point of that. And it become very, you know, people in Congress, Mario Diaz-Balart was very supportive. Jeb Bush got involved. He was very supportive of it. And so did former Governor Martinez from Orlando. And so you had people, you know, saying, hey, these people had grown up here, they'd gone through all our system, you know, they don't need to be punished for something, you know, that their parents did.
Right.
So, and, you know, it frankly, it makes for good politics here in 2014 as far as the governor's race. I mean, how Dade goes is going to be very critical to both Governor Scott and to former Governor Crist.
So is it going to be, what's Nan Rich?
Nan Rich is still out there. She's, I think, raised $500,000. I mean, it's in comparison to Scott's talking about, you know, having a $100 million campaign. Charlie would be happy as a clam, you know, if he had $60, $75 million in his war chest. She's not gotten traction. And, you know, she's a well-known Broward senator, highly respected within the Democratic Party. She doesn't have state name recognition, and I get her emails and her campaign mm-hmm. emails, how, you know, she's traveling the state and everything else. And but without that money, it's going to be tough. These guys are, this is going to be a brutal gubernatorial campaign.
Looks like it's already started.
Well, and it's already started. You're seeing the ads already. You know, Charlie Crist ran off when the state of Florida economy tanked. He ran off to, you know, try to go to Washington. And then that didn't work out for him. But, I mean, they're going to get more vicious. I mean,
right.
you're seeing a lot of them now, but in some ways they're, like, almost feel good. You know, they're taking a punch, but they don't want to, leave you a bloody mess. Not too
Gee,
early.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Let's look at the Democrats weren't satisfied with the session, some of them, because of several issues that they said weren't even tackled, raising the minimum wage, expanding Medicaid to more Floridians. What repercussions will that have?
Well, you know, the question for the Democrats, who have, I think, a 400,000 vote majority statewide, as far as registered voters, is can they get their people, voters out to the polls? In an off-year elections, excluding presidential, the Dems, and this is why we have a Republican governor and a Republican-dominated Senate and House, the Republicans have a significantly better ability to get their voters to the polls and actually vote. I used to joke, the Democrats have a big festival or something, get out the vote at, you know, Tamiami Park or whatever, and then at the end of it, they all go home, versus if it was a Republican thing, there would be a bus that would take all these people
to the polls,
to the early voting sites, and actually vote. And
did anything happen with that, by the way, the early voting?
No, they've opened up some of the different sites, or they've changed some of the rules that were making it more flexible for the supervisor of elections of the different counties. You know, they can use schools. I mean, they have always used schools, but they're given a couple more options as far as, and I think it's still 7 days.
It's still only going to be the 7 days. And what about that gambling compact you mentioned about?
Well, you know, Scott essentially prematurely mentioned that he was working on a deal with the Seminoles and for some kind of like global gaming compact, mm-hmm. and you know, the Senate and the House essentially said, well, you know, if it's something done, we'll take a look at it. But nothing really came of it. And Scott has said on the media over the weekend that, you know, they're negotiating. You know, negotiating is always, you know, takes time, et cetera. And, but he hopes, you know, down the road to have something. And we'll see if he's able to get his legislatures to have a special session.
And what happened with the stadium issue? You said, well, the legislature.
This is a down here. It's important because it's a hot topic. The whole idea of the David Beckham,
right,
the superstar soccer player, and his new stadium, and how he wants it at the port. And there is some mechanism now for some of these sports teams to get some rebates if they compete, and potentially the Miami or the Beckham deal could be one of them. So that's, if you're a stadium supporter, that's a good thing. Now, that said, at the county commission, people have been talking about a site at the Port of Miami. And at the county commission, you have people, specifically Linda Bell, Commissioner Bell, vice chair, who is very upset about the recent downgrading of the bond. And they weren't aware when they made some votes a couple of months ago that it was going to have such ramifications, because the county carries about $13 or $14 billion in debt. It finances out to about $23 billion, but I mean, it our bond rating is a big deal, because you end up paying, you know,
right,
extra for an inferior rating.
So, any other issues, notable issues, failed? That beer, craft beer thing? Why
well,
did that?
Yeah, this is one, I don't know. They call them a growler. It's some kind of large beer container. But the liquor companies want these small boutique breweries to essentially not be able to distribute it. They have to go through a big company. So.
Yeah, that doesn't seem, well, I guess big business.
Well, it
influence
is, yeah,
that. What else are you following on this week's Watchdog Report? Or what else are you
well,
following?
Tomorrow we have Miami-Dade County Commission. I actually feel like the chambers is like my living room. I've been there. I mean, it took me 2 years. I'll never forget, in the 98, 99, I arrived there. And, you know, it's almost a 500-seat facility. I mean, it's a big, you know, chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't feel that comfortable there. And it's later on, it's one of the reasons in my watchdog, there's a certain tier of the subject matter, and it's based on the size of the public institution.
I see,
you know?
Yes.
I mean, I start with the state,
right,
or national state, Miami-Dade County, school board next, and the public health trust, you know. And I try to tell people in some of the, you know, we have 34 municipalities. And once in a while, you know, some of their elected leaders forget that, you know, they have a smaller chamber. I mean, you know, I love local government, but let's be honest. I mean, you have some big entities here that dwarf.
Right.
I mean, and I know what it was. Former Steve Shiver, when he's manager of the county, used to go, "Why don't you go to Homestead more?" And I said, "Steve, you have more people working for you than." You know, in this building and in the county, than live in Homestead. So why am I going? You know, I have no beef with Homestead.
Right.
But I mean, you know, I always went to the bigger, where the big money, when they're talking billions rather than $2 million or whatever. And $2 million is important. But you know, the big institutions were the ones that were also the hardest to understand.
Well, let's see. 15 years of the Watchdog Report to get it. They write publisher at
watchdogreport.net. Or you can go online, watchdogreport.net, and there's a thing, contact me, and people do it that way.
Okay.
But it's been an amazing, from my standpoint, back in 1990, I was single with no kids. Someone needed to step forward and really start watching this place, because government that is watched, you know, by someone that isn't beating their chest or trying to push their own
issue. Right, right.
I mean, that's probably the most significant thing that I did was keep it like AP and not inject a lot of my own personal feelings into it. And I joke, I don't have a phone to God, because some people just come up, you have to do this, you have to, you know, they're absolutely sure they're right and everyone else is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I don't fly that way.
No, you keep it pretty objective.
Yeah.
You know?
And I joke, I don't have a phone to God. I call, he doesn't pick up, you know.
Well, Dan Ricker, thanks so much.
Well, Bonnie, it was a pleasure. I wish Joe was here.
I wish Joe was here, too.
You know, I mean, we had a lot of experiences together.
I know. You want to tell us about that one before we go?
Well, I was reading, there was a politician that ran for office here in Miami-Dade, but he lived in Broward, and he was brought to in front of a judge. And after all the testimony, the judge wrote a 45-page opinion, essentially saying, you know, he perverted he was the worst kind of person in the world to have tried to run for public office, yet didn't even live in the district where he was running, and, you know, it was not a good mark. But anyway, so I'm reading this, and the gentleman actually comes into the studio while we're on.
He just appeared here.
He just appeared here, and Joe didn't know who he was, and Joe goes, oh, we need a little security here, you know, whatever. You know, and I'm like, whoa. But it's been fun. I mean, being on LRN, and this has been, I tell people, this is one of the only fun things I get to do. So,
regular contributor Dan Ricker, watchdogreport.net, if you're interested. And we'll see you again soon.
Right.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Always a pleasure, Bonnie.
Bye-bye. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. So happy to have you with us. Joseph Cooper is away. Jewish Floridians have a very long history of serving within all branches and ranks of the U.S. military, from the Seminole Wars right up to Afghanistan. WLRN's new original documentary, A Call to Serve, Florida Jews in the U.S. Military, pays tribute to those who served in or those who made the ultimate sacrifice for their country. Joining us in the studio, we welcome the producer and writer of the film, Steve Waxman.
Hi, Bonnie.
Steve is a veteran TV producer whose documentary writing and producing credits include the PBS-aired program Great Entrepreneurs, along with the Emmy-nominated Prohibition and the South Florida Connection, and the recently broadcast Instruments of Change, both of which had their TV premieres on WLRN. And let's see, we have the Colonel on. I want to introduce, let me just introduce the Colonel who's with us. Welcome. Are you there, Colonel Abramowitz?
I'm right here.
Okay. So by phone, we welcome Colonel Ben Abramowitz. Ben heads up the Abramowitz clan, who have served in the U.S. military for over a century. Good afternoon to you.
Oh, good afternoon to you. Glad to hear you.
Thank you. And we're waiting for Marcia Zurovitz to join us, and we'll introduce her in a minute. But before we do, let's begin with you, Steve. And first, I want to actually congratulate all of you because the documentary is really good. I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot from it.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. That's why we do them.
Yeah, and I encourage you to see it. It will be on WLRN Channel 17 Tuesday, May 13th at 9 p.m., and it will re-air on Sunday, May 18th and Thursday, May 29th. So, let me ask you, you produced this. Why? Did you set out to prove something? Did you set out to dispel myths about Jews in the military? Well, what was your goal?
Well, actually, it was an exhibit at the Jewish Museum on South Miami Beach, and I walked in there, and I was fascinated. I saw these artifacts and stories and people's dedication. So I just thought there's got to be some great stories here. And sure enough, you know, reading through the exhibit and then contacting some people either via the exhibit or through other sources, I was able to really put together a compelling, I guess you'd call it, video postcards from the wars, people's dedication to serving the country. You know, at first I didn't know what the focus was, and it's always difficult at times with documentaries to find your focus, but the focus was that here were people who were willing to give back to their country, who gave so much to them as Jewish people. So that once I established the focus, I was able to then pursue my goals of informing and entertaining and enlightening.
And, okay, joining us now, I believe by phone, is Marcia Zurovitz. She's the founding executive director of the Jewish Museum of Florida at FIU. And Marcia served as one of the main on-camera narrators, provided amazing and colorful facts about Jewish military participation. Marcia, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay, so let's turn to now Colonel Abramowitz. Your story is very beautiful. I'd like to begin by asking you to give us a little history. You have four generations of your family who've served in the military, dating back to World War I. Tell us a little about them and your own service in Vietnam. What drew you and your family to the military?
Well, thanks a lot. Actually, it's about 99 and a half years, I wouldn't want to embellish too much.
Okay, well, we'll forgive you we'll forgive
okay,
ourselves.
My father arrived in this country when he was 5 years old, and they're very poor on the Lower East Side. His father was murdered soon after he got here. His mother had five siblings. One night he came home for dinner, and there were six chairs and seven people, so he enlisted the next day at 14 years old. And that was in 1916.
Wasn't that a little young?
Pardon me?
Wasn't that too young to enlist?
Everything is too young, but who had a birth certificate and who asked a lot of questions?
Right,
okay. Recruits. Okay. And he spent the next 35 years in the Army. And he started out and he only had a third grade education. And he ended up through lots of different things. He ended up as a lieutenant colonel and commandant of the signal school in Europe. And the field house at Fort Monmouth was named after him, and also the communication center at Fort Gordon as an educator, athlete, and soldier.
Okay.
He was married in 1933. I was born in 1934. I always wanted to be a soldier, and I was. And we lived in Europe. I saw the Nuremberg trials. I came back. I went to Virginia Tech, was commissioned, and served 28 years as an infantryman and then and as a helicopter pilot. My oldest son graduated from the Air Force Academy, was commissioned in the Army, and he served 30 years. He just recently retired, and he runs the Northeast region of DCF today. My middle son, Sid, was commissioned in reserves out of Tulsa University, and he was drafted into the professional of the NFL mm-hmm. and played pro football for 4 years, and he was called up for Desert Storm, and he left the Army and graded captain after her serving his time. My youngest son, Alan, went to Kansas State University and also an attorney. He was commissioned in the Signal Corps, just like his grandfather was.
Right.
And he served his time in the Army, became a lawyer, and now he runs the Guardian Ad Litem program in Florida.
And then your grandson also now.
And then we have two grandsons in the Army. One is Jacob, who's a captain, graduated from West Point in 2009. And Alex is a combat medic with the 82nd Airborne Division.
Well, it's an amazing.
So,
I'm sorry.
A lot of generations.
Yeah, well, we thank you all for your, great service. It's really quite a legacy you've had. Marcia, you said there are three reasons that Jews want to serve in the military. What are they?
First of all, I'd like to mention that this is Jewish American Heritage Month, so it's especially timely, a time to educate about and celebrate the contributions of American Jews to the fabric of our nation's history, culture, and society. The ultimate human drama plays out in the military because it encompasses all the emotions and experiences of life and death, bravery and cowardice, love and leaving, adventure and terror. The main reason that Jews joined were, first of all, to play their patriotism. They came, many of them, as new immigrants, and they wanted to assume responsibility in their new land, especially those that came in the early war years. They were motivated by their Jewish identity. They wanted to become accepted, to overcome the concept of the wandering Jew from centuries ago with mm-hmm. no loyalty. And they wanted to show that they were not draft dodgers or cowards. They learned to fight, and they learned to see themselves in new ways, holding two identities, American and Jewish. And I think one of the most important things that it did by that Jews and men and women in the military served was that it would help reduce anti-Semitism, especially in World War II when more than 500,000 served, because Jews joining the military faced ignorance. That was the greatest hurdle for them. They were Jews serving in the military introduced America to Jews. Most servicemen had never met a Jew and actually thought the Jews had horns. So the actions and bravery by these Jews showed in essential ways that they were not different from others. So I think that's really important.
And Steve, do you feel like that has come across in the documentary?
Well, I think what came across in the documentary for me anyway was their individual stories of how dedicated they were to the country. And, you know, by showing their dedication, hopefully that in itself will dispel any of the myths or stereotypes that Marcia just discussed. So I just wanted them to say, you know, actions speak louder than words. And so hopefully their actions and their words dispelled any of the myths that existed prior to, World War II or even commonplace today's.
Right. Although I
and
did.
Speaking of myths, like I wanted to mention
go ahead.
The story, like the Jews in the military.
One second, Colonel. Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
Marcia?
Jews in the military is a stereotype defining an often overlooked demographic in the U.S. military. The story that Steve tells in this really important film debunks a huge myth, the perception that Jews have not been patriotic in proportion to our percentage of the population, when in reality, Jewish women and men have served in every war in numbers far beyond the percentage of the population in every role and rank, earning many medals. Some prisoners of war, many made this ultimate sacrifice. So it's a huge story. And I'm just so pleased that Steve was able to do this because it demonstrates the nation's ideals of freedom and democracy, promoting peace for future generations, and that Jews had a very major role in this.
We are talking about a WLRN original documentary, A Call to Serve, Florida Jews and the U.S. Military. It was produced and written by Steve Waxman, who's in the studio. Also joining us, Ben Abramowitz, who's the head of the, Colonel Ben Abramowitz, who's the head of the Abramowitz clan, who served in the U.S. military for about a century. And you just heard the voice of Marcia Zurovitz, who is one of the main on-camera narrators in the film and is the founding executive director of the Jewish Museum of Florida at FIU. On today's Topical Currents, we have a lot to talk about, but we need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back. And we're talking about, good afternoon, it's Topical Currents, for say that, Bonnie Berman here. We're talking about the WLRN original documentary, A Call to Serve, Florida Jews in the U.S. Military. It's being screened at Cinema Paradiso, actually this Wednesday, but that event is filled. Is that correct, Steve?
Yeah, it's filled.
Okay, so no more room.
No more room.
For that, but the television premiere will be on Tuesday, May 13th, 9 p.m., on Channel 17.
And there's plenty of room for that, right?
Plenty of room for that. We'll take all comers. And also, it'll re-air on Sunday, May 18th and Thursday, May 29th at 9 p.m. Is there a website associated with this if our listeners want to find out when it's going to air? How do they do that? Go to channels?
Well, usually WLRN.
Just WLRN.org.
Yeah. And there is a website, I believe, either in development right now or will be done early this week. But yeah, they'll be able to find it through the WLRN.org.
Okay. Very good. Colonel Abramowitz, you wanted to add something before when we were talking.
Yes.
Go ahead.
This will complement what Steve and Marcia said. I spent all 20 years as a combat infantryman, also flew for 8 of those years. But anyway, I was on the faculty of the Commander General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, and I was teaching a class with 50 majors in the room. And the class was on personnel management or whatever it was on. And one of the officers in the room, they were all majors, they're there for a year, supposedly the cream to cream of the Army, the top 50%. He stood up, he says, you know, Colonel, you're the first Jew I've ever seen with a combat infantryman badge. And he says, all the Jews I've known have been lawyers and doctors and quartermaster officers, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And my response was, you know who that guy is sitting next to you? And he said, yeah, that's my friend Jack Jacobs. And I said, well, Jack Jacobs is one of our people. He has the Medal of Honor. And, of course, Jack is now a commentator on MSNBC. At that time, if there are any preconceptions of Jews in the military, and that 50, now that was a significant emotional event for 50 people, and what it did was a great teaching moment. And it was not planned. It was just like a target of opportunity.
Right.
And when I said that, that just changed a lot of people's minds about Jews serving this country.
Steve, did you want to add something?
No, I mean, what Colonel Bromwich said is correct. But again, you know, what we try to do in the film is because of the timeline and the amount of people we wanted to cover, by them telling their own stories in a way that showed their passion, again, we showed that their stories will hopefully overcome any of these myths that we talked about previously.
Well,
and Steve's, this is Ben again, Steve's film does it. It's excellent, and it tells, it will hold you for an hour.
Absolutely.
Every one of those stories is interesting, poignant, and has merit.
Yes, it certainly does. I go ahead.
I was going to say thank you, Colonel.
Yes. I wanted to look at Erwin Stovroff, who's profiled in the film. It was an amazing story. Could you set this up? Because we have the audio clip, and I was so touched by it. But if you could set up this clip.
Well, Erwin was, I'm not sure of the actual clip, but Erwin was, do you have the...
Well, it's when he was...
It's
when he was shot down.
Okay.
Well, at first he talked about what he had to do, and then he was shot down.
Well, Erwin was a bombardier, and he flew on D-Day, and he got shot down and was behind German lines, and I think the clip will speak for itself.
We flew two missions on D-Day. The channel was nothing but boats, ships, everything you could think of, men. So we looked down, you could see it. They must have known really that we were coming, because they hit us real hard. They hit our number one and number two engine. The hydraulic system failed. There was flame starting to come into the cabin itself. So we got our chutes on and everybody started to bail out. After floating, which seemed like an hour, I fell to the ground. I knew the Germans were there because we were in the front lines. I went into this room and it was a young Nazi officer. And he said to me, I know you can be very helpful. He said, because I want to know all about your group. And I said, I can only give you my name, rank, and serial number. And seriously, that's all I really knew. I knew none of our plans because only the commanding officers knew what we were doing. This went on at least three times. And on the fourth time, this officer said, German Nazi, said to me, Lieutenant, I know who you are and I know what you are. When he said that, I knew I was in trouble. He named my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, my grammar school, my high school, the jobs that I had. And I'm just sitting there, I said, I don't believe this. And he said, well, you see, you lived in Buffalo, New York on Claremont Avenue. And my parents lived on Ashland Avenue, which was the next street over. And he said, you were my parents' newspaper boy. And he said to me, I can help you. And I said, I still have nothing I can tell you. And what he did, I found out afterwards, he put a question mark under religion. I ended up in Stalagluf number one. One morning at a roll call, they start calling off names. And suddenly you realize that those were names of Jewish guys. There was about 250 Jewish guys had been shot down. They put a fence around us, and we could not go from one area to another. But what really saved our lives was our commanding officer.
Okay, tell us now what happened.
Well, I don't want to give it
away. You don't
want
to give it away.
And,
right.
But I just want to say Erwin Stovroff was key in this documentary. He put me in contact with other people, one who worked on the bridge over Rukwai, which is a rare event to get somebody on camera who did that. Another gentleman who served as a medic in Korea. So, you know, I'm just indebted to him, and his story is so compelling. We don't want to give away the whole piece.
Right.
But Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to also say he founded this Vets Helping Heroes in West Palm Beach, and he said that's the proudest thing he's ever done. What is that?
Well, what he does is he gets dogs to help interact with vets so that it helps calm them from coming back from the war and offers them emotional solace and things like that. So that's one of his big passions. I don't know if it's the proudest thing. If he had kids, that might have been a little prouder, but he's very proud of the setup up there in West Palm Beach.
You know, there were so many profiles in this that I wanted to talk about with you, Steve, and to talk to the Colonel and Marcia. Marcia, you say that World War II was a major factor in raising the Jewish population of Miami Beach. Just tell us a little about that. We're so short on time. I wish we had the whole hour, but unfortunately we didn't.
Well, when the military came to Miami Beach, they took over 70% of the hotels, and many, it was for officer training candidate school. And so many of the men and women who came were Jews. So they loved the climate, of course. The hospitality of the Jewish community there was extremely welcoming. Rabbi Meshulov, who was at Beth Jacob congregation, was very welcoming and had services and dedicated a Torah and so forth. So after the military, after the war, these military women and men were very motivated to come back to Miami Beach, and that's when the population really swelled. Before that, Jacksonville was the largest Jewish community in the state, but after World War II, it did become Miami Beach.
Marcia, what about your interest in the Jews and the military? What inspired that?
Well, the stories, I grew up in West Virginia, and I always had heard that Jews did not serve in their proportion. So this had always plagued me, because I'm very strongly identified as a Jew, been very involved in the Jewish community my entire life. So when I started hearing these stories, I was the one that collected all the material to develop the Mosaic Jewish Life in Florida exhibit starting in the early 80s that was then became the Jewish Museum of Florida. We now have a collection over 100,000 photographs and items. This all started when I was traveling around the state, meeting with families and gathering things out of family albums. And as I was doing that, going through that process, I found more and more stories of the military, and I was like, whoa, this story is way more than I had ever expected because of all the stereotyped images that I had heard. So it took me years. We developed the exhibit that was shown at the Jewish Museum of Florida in 2010 over many, many years. And it had a very broad scope. It showed over stories of over 300 women and men, more than 500 photographs, 300 artifacts that included uniforms, hundreds of medals and documents. And I found this a truly inspiring story, as is so well illustrated in what Steve did with this film. It shows to me that America has accepted the Jews as patriotic, finally, at last, and that Jews love America like everybody else and want to protect it.
Right.
So this is a very powerful story.
I can tell it's very dear to your heart. Well, Steve, I wanted to talk about Mitchell Wolfson and his thing in the Army and Meyer Lansky's relative. There's so many profiles, but we just don't have the time. But I do want to say that the name of this WLRN original documentary that was written and produced by Steve Waxman is A Call to Serve Florida Jews in the U.S. Military. It premieres on television Tuesday, May 13th, 9 p.m., and it'll re-air Sunday, May 18th and Thursday, May 29th.
No, that's. I hope everybody will tune in and watch it. It was challenging to put together for the reasons that Marcia said. There was so much good stuff, and I hope that I did everybody justice. And I can't thank the contributors enough, especially Ms. Zarevitz and the Colonel, who were with me all the way from start to finish.
Well, we want to thank Marcia Zarevitz. She is the founding director of, if I can find it, an executive director of the Jewish Museum of Florida at FIU, and Colonel Ben Abramowitz, who is the head of the Abramowitz clan, served in the U.S. military for over a century. We thank both of you for joining us. And Steve Waxman, great luck with the film, and it's really good, and we thank you for making it.
Thank you, Bonnie, for having me.
And thank you for having us, Bonnie.
Thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you. That is Topical Currents today. Pleasure to have you with us. Producers Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Go to WLRN.org for more information on this program and on A Call to Serve, all at the WLRN website. Tomorrow's program is with New York Magazine contributing editor Jennifer Senior. She's written All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Bonnie Berman wishing you a very good Monday. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News. Thanks so much for joining us.